I suppose you're wondering what you're doing here.
It had crossed my mind. What's it all about?
Sit down and I'll tell you. It's a question of your resignation.
Go on.
The information in your head is priceless. I don't think you realize what a valuable property you've become. A man like you is worth a great deal on the open market.
Who brought me here?
I know how you feel, believe me. And they have taken quite a liberty.
Who are they?
A lot of people are curious about what lies behind your resignation. You had a brilliant career. Your record is impeccable. They want to know why you suddenly left.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Bombs going off in the middle of a peace rally. Who but the war machine would stand to gain from that? Over 100 mostly Kurdish peace activists were killed in the Turkish capital Ankara last Saturday. Even more seriously injured, and those that were trying to help the victims were tear-gassed by police for their trouble. But to show they're not afraid, even more came out onto the streets the day after. The government in Turkey say it was an ISIS suicide bomber, or two perhaps, but the activists say the Turkish government planted bombs in the crowd. Never mind Saddam and Gaddafi, are NATO governments turning on their own people? And fake stories about Russian jets being shot down and Russian cruise missiles crashing in Iran. Who plants these stories in the press, and why don't editors check to see if they're true before they send those lies around the world? Dutch investigators this week say Malaysian airliner MH17 was shot down by a Russian-made missile, probably a Buk. But what about the black box and cockpit voice recorder? Do they really have no evidence at all? How do we know? Also, Al Megrahi's dead, but there are new suspects this week in the 1988 Pan Am 103 Lockerbie bombing from Libya. Fed up with years of lies, relatives of the victims, though, say, show us the evidence that they were involved. And a dictatorship run by banks and corporations, or more jobs. What will TTIP mean for Bristol? And Martin Summers gets his chance, as he does every week, to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. Now, we'll start with Ankara, Martin. I imagine you've been scrying the internet to try and find out what was going on there. What's your assessment of it?
Intelligence services, MIT, and the military engaging in false flag terrorist attacks. So lots of people in Turkey are well aware that the state could have a hand in this.
Okay, so what extent does Erdogan and the government actually know about and involved in this, or is it something which the security services are off doing on their own?
Historically, something called Ergonicon was the network inside Turkey that carried out the same kind of attacks as was carried out in Western Europe by the Gladio network. So Ergonicon was the Turkish version of Gladio. And if people are listening to the show, if they want to check this, they can look this up later on the internet for themselves. But in other words, in Turkey, there's a wide understanding across the population that the state, in fact, does engage in terrorist actions, and therefore a suspicion that they were involved in this attack. And incidentally, the Erdogan government tried to blame the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, tried to blame ISIS. And of course, many of the activists believe that ISIS is actually... working with the Turkish government, because the evidence shows that it was. Until very recently, the Turkish government and the MIT and the Turkish military were all part of NATO, were arming and training ISIS militants and infiltrating them into Syria. And another bomb at a similar rally in southern Turkey is what brought the PKK to end its ceasefire and to start fighting the Turkish army again, because they said that the ISIS attack on their rally was facilitated by the Turkish government. And I'm afraid many people in Turkey simply believe, you know, and they've good reason to believe it, that the Turkish military and the deep state in Turkey is working with ISIS. So if it was ISIS, that's the same as the Turkish deep state.
Now, we hear about killing their own people. We hear this attached regularly in the press to people like Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein.
And Assad in Syria. Most people in Britain and around the world in the Western world are blissfully unaware of the fact that 30,000 to 40,000 people have died in Turkey in the last 20 odd years in a conflict between the Kurds and the Turkish government. And the reason we haven't heard about it is because the Turkish government is an integral part of NATO. Their chaps are trained at Sandhurst, and the 30,000 to 40,000 deaths in eastern Turkey don't count. Whereas, of course, we hear everything about what's going on, the evil things about that Assad does in Syria. He's an enemy of the West, and therefore his evil behaviour is constantly drawn to our attention.
Now, one of the things I've not heard any of the commentary this week at all about this Ergenekon network. That was largely people involved in the law enforcement and also the military, wasn't it, in Turkey. Loads of arrests. What was happening with that was that it was almost like a sort of backlash against the idea of integration with the European Union and with NATO. Yes, it was. You're shaking your head, but what was happening was that it was a nationalist. Ergenekon was supposedly a nationalist network where generals who were much more pro Turkey taking a different foreign policy to other countries were attracted towards that network.
Ergenekon was essentially, an effective part of NATO. Don't forget that Turkey's got a very strong left-wing tradition, as represented by the HDP, for example, who organised the demonstration, and by other socialist forces. And the first IMF programme of structural adjustment was imposed in Turkey after the military took power in 1980. But in the run-up to the military in Turkey, part of NATO, taking power in 1980, there had been massive terrorist actions, supposedly by left-wing groups and right-wing groups. And in the run-up to this demonstration, the HDP, which is the Kurdish National Party, which got 13% in the elections and overwhelmingly won in Kurdistan, their offices of their political party have been attacked by armed thugs organised by the so-called Grey Wolves. The Grey Wolves are the kind of foot soldiers of Ergenekon. So just as in Italy we had the bombings in Bologna railway station in 1980, this is not a specifically Turkish phenomenon. What we have is that NATO intelligence services and military have always engaged in false flag terrorism. I think we can say that without a shadow of a doubt, speaking in 2015. We now have decades of evidence which have come to light through police investigations. In Turkey, several top military generals were sent to prison by the Erdogan government for being involved in exactly these kind of activities. What seems to have happened to now is that Erdogan, who at one stage was opposed to the NATO military in Turkey, has now probably put in it that they're now working on the same team to achieve various geopolitical goals which are satisfactory to NATO. So I don't necessarily see this as an entirely Turkish phenomenon. Don't forget, we have been supplying and arming terrorist groups inside Syria for 3 and 4 years, who have killed tens of thousands of people. So another 100 dead in Ankara is just a cherry on the cake.
The Ergenekon network were successfully accused and people have been sent to jail for this as being part of the deep state. Maybe you could explain a bit what that term means, because that's popped up in the news over the last couple of weeks for the first time I've ever heard it, actually, the deep state discussed. And what they were doing was assassinating intellectuals, politicians, judges, military staff and religious leaders in Turkey.
Yeah, so what you do is you attack either innocent demonstrators or Piazza Fontana in 1969 in Italy. They planted a bomb in the Banco Agricola in Milan and killed 9 customers. They also were involved in shooting and bombing of police officers. And the purpose of this, I mean, when the military took power in Turkey in 1980, they had been orchestrating all of this terror. So they were running both left and right wing and Islamist groups, all of whom were engaging in terrorist activities. The state was the situation was in chaos, and when the military took over, they were able to, everybody breathed a sigh of relief, thank goodness the military will now be able to put a stop to all of this. And surprise, surprise, all of the terrorism stopped when the military had taken over. But of course the purpose of that was to prevent Turkey following a development path hostile to that of the Western powers.
We've had all these trials, the Agenikon people, most of them anyway, are behind bars, and yet the terrorist attacks are still going on.
Well, because the people who've been sent to prison and put behind bars in Turkey are the tip of the iceberg, and the structures for which they operated still continue to exist. What has happened, I think, is that at one stage Erdogan's Justice and Development Party was regarded as a threat to the status quo, and they were you know, basically victims of Ergonican manipulation. I now think that Erdogan has made his peace with the Ergonican networks, and that the AKP, his party, is now regarded as a safe pair of hands by NATO. And they are undermining any potential change in Turkish politics, which would push them in a direction opposite to that which is satisfactory to Washington and London.
Wasn't this always going to happen in Turkey, though? Because you've got what was originally, anyway, before Ataturk, a Muslim country rather similar, say, to Iran, with a long tradition. Okay, they had their empire. And yet they're in this kind of contradictory position right on the eastern extremities of NATO. A lot of what NATO is doing is attacking Islamic countries, and yet they themselves are an Islamic country. So isn't it inevitable that Turkey is going to be a flashpoint?
Well, when Erdogan came to power some years ago now, and his prime minister, Davutoglu, I can't remember how to pronounce his name, they said, we've got a policy of zero problems with our neighbours. We're just going to be friendly with everybody that surrounds us. But of course you've got the Kurdish issue, which is burning away in Turkish politics, and
so
has
they don't
been.
Count the Kurds as part
no
of
well the Kurds they've never been given the right to be non-Turkish in there. I mean, it's they speak a different language, for example, and they are a minority within Turkey, but in, you know, about half the geographic space of Turkey is occupied by the Kurdish minority, and the Kurdish minority in fact has a strong diaspora in big cities like Ankara. And so the HDP, which is the Kurdish party, which got 13% of the vote in the last election, which denied Erdogan the majority he needed to set up a presidential system, they also draw votes from left-leaning Turks as well as from, it's as if Sinn Féin was standing in Britain and they got votes from left leaning English people, even though they're basically a nationalist party. And I think that the sophistication of the Kurds in Turkey needs to be recognised. The PKK has called numerous ceasefires, and their position has always been that we realise that we can't just set up an independent state, because this will have implications for places like Syria and Iraq and Iran, and it could cause all sorts of problems. So we just want to have a much better deal within the federal state of Turkey.
Martin, I'm effectively in Kosovo. That happened with the West's approval.
Well, exactly. Why isn't the RAF bombing Turkish positions now so that the PKK, as the Kosovo Liberation Army did, could declare independence? And the reason is, of course, that the PKK are the Kurdistan Workers' Party. They have welcomed, for example, the PKK and the HDP have welcomed the Turkish intervention in Syria.
So the
Russian intervention in Syria, and they oppose Turkish intervention.
Okay, so
what's interesting about the PKK is not only that their politics, which are quite sophisticated, it's also their military capability. They've been fighting NATO, the Turkish army, for 30 years. And their people are extremely experienced, which is why they're the main opposition to ISIS inside Syria.
I noticed even at the rally last Saturday where these bombs went off and 100 people were killed, people were carrying banners saying the Turkish state are the killers, and they were talking about killing them.
Yeah, well, they're right. And of course, as you said earlier on in this programme, more people turned out to protest the day after the killings than the day before. And if whoever did it, and I suspect it is ISIS working with elements within the Turkish state, they are basically digging their own grave, because ultimately we are going to see a major war in Turkey between the Kurdistan Workers Party and their allies and the national government. The national government will be backed by the West.
So are you saying the Kurds could say
yes? Well, the opening shots have been fired a long time ago. The opening shots were fired at Suruk a few weeks ago, because there'd been a ceasefire to that point. Now, you could easily see a situation where if the Turks, for example, carry on supporting ISIS inside Syria, as they have been doing, with the support of the Americans and the British, it has to be said, that the Russians could say, right, the PKK, maybe we're going to put in a no-fly zone over Kurdish Turkey so that the NATO jets can't bomb the PKK. This is the sort of thing that we've done in Iraq and Libya, and they could do the same thing, because they're now in a position to do so, because they're based just over the border in Syria.
I mean, what about all the allegations? If you look around, you'll find there are quite a few that the Turks have actually been training ISIS.
Well, I think that's overwhelmingly the case. There's no doubt about it. I mean
what does Erdogan get out of this?
Well, don't forget
that he's heading towards a civil war.
Don't forget that Erdogan's political background is he's basically an Ikhwan, a Muslim brother. And the Muslim brothers were also the core of the anti-Assad forces in Syria, and also, of course, the Morsi government in Egypt. So Erdogan, from a policy of having a kind of friendly relationship with Assad, decided that he could gain more by pushing Assad out. And he's basically a Sunni Muslim nationalist, and he's supported Sunni extremists inside Syria to overthrow Assad. Unfortunately for him, Assad has proved to be far stronger than he anticipated. And now, of course, instead of Assad being overthrown, it's quite possible that Erdogan will be out of office before Assad is.
What about his relationship with Russia? He says he wants to be friends with everybody, but the Russians have been overflying Turkey, apparently. Well, why do you think they've done that?
Well, I don't believe that the Russians... What's actually happened is that the Turks put in a self-designated no-fly zone 5 kilometres into Syria, and said no plane is allowed to cross into that 5 kilometre corridor. Now, in actual fact, there's no legal basis for that. The Russian planes were flying in that corridor. They
Poor
weren't actually
Syria.
Flying inside.
You do feel sorry for them. I mean, they've just been completely land-grabbed. What with the Golan Heights as well?
Well, I mean, the point is that as I've mentioned many times on this programme, Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, is on the television in France saying that when he was foreign minister of France before the Arab Spring, he was approached by British officials who said, we are going to run an armed uprising in Syria, do you want to participate? And I think the evidence is overwhelming that NATO intelligence services, working with the Gulf Cooperation Council, the Saudis and the Qataris, planned an uprising in Syria to remove Assad. Therefore, they are responsible for starting the war, and they are responsible for the millions of refugees and hundreds of thousands of casualties. They are responsible, and if there was any justice, they should be going to The Hague. But of course, at this stage of the game, nobody's talking like that.
What about this contradiction I talked about earlier about the Muslim country Turkey being part of NATO, which is in many places fighting Islam? It was sort of secularised with Ataturk at the end of the Ottoman Empire, and there's been a lot of pressure, hasn't there, for it to go back a little bit like the revolution that happened in Iran, but it never happened in Turkey.
Well,
so let's just use your crystal ball for a minute, Martin. Which way do you think Turkey's going to go?
Well, if you remember, Tony, during the 2003 Iraq war, Turkey refused to participate. They just wouldn't allow Incirlik Air Base to be used to attack Iraq.
This is by the American base, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that what will happen is we're going to have a general Middle East war. That's what's going to happen. And that's why the Iranians and the Russians are already in Syria. The West could decide to intervene on behalf of its protégés, as they already are in Yemen and elsewhere, and we're all going to war. You get these people on our show and general saying they're not pacifists, and the various right-wingers in the Labour Party saying they're not pacifists. Well, you know what? nor am I. And if you go to war against the UN and you try to overthrow legitimate governments, Syria, the Assad's government won the democratic election in 2012 in that country. They won it convincingly. You go to war against people like that, you deserve to lose, and you will lose.
Now, some of this was discussed at Prime Minister's Questions this week with Angus Robertson from the SNP bringing up the whole subject of the Middle East.
The UK has been involved in three major military interventions in recent years, and in all cases there have been very severe unintended consequences. The Taliban sadly control much of Afghanistan again. In Iraq, the fanatics of Daesh terrorise about half of the country. In Libya, there has been total anarchy and chaos. What assurances can the Prime Minister give that he's learnt the lessons from past mistakes and he will not repeat them?
Well, I think the Honourable Gentleman makes an important point. I make two points to him. One is, of course, intervention has consequences, but frankly, non-intervention can have consequences too, as we see from the vast numbers of Syrians fleeing the appalling situation in that country, not least the barrel bomb chemical weapons attacks by Bashar Assad. So it is worth making that point. In terms of the lessons learnt, I can't wait for the Iraq inquiry to come out, so further lessons can be learned. But we've already learned a number of lessons, for instance, setting up the National Security Council, which is working well, making sure we act on the basis of clear legal advice, and the Attorney General attends all the important meetings, and working with allies and local partners. So while it's frustrating what is happening in both Iraq and Syria, one of the lessons is to work with local partners. In Iraq, it is Iraqi troops that are the boots on the ground, and that's why we should give them all the support that they need in the war they're fighting against ISIL.
Well, I mean, the Iraqi government, which is Shia-led, have also called for the Russians to extend their bombing campaign in Syria into Iraq. The same government has actually claims, I don't know whether it's true, they claim to have shot down two British planes who were dropping supplies to ISIS. Now, in other words, there's a complete disconnect between this discussion in the British Parliament and the reality of the situation.
Well, we had
the
journalist Alex Perry on here last week, who was working for Newsweek. He was the Time magazine's correspondent for a whole of Africa, and he was saying basically for journalists, Syria is an information black hole.
Yes, well, I'm coming back to what the Prime Minister said about chemical weapons used by Assad. Now, in actual fact, the evidence, as Seymour Hersh, the very, very well-regarded US journalist, has pointed out in the London Review of Books, the evidence is overwhelming that chemical weapons attack was carried out by the al-Nusra Front with sarin supplied from Libya by the NATO intelligence services, specifically the MIT from Turkey, working with the Saudis. Now, in other words, not only did Assad not use chemical weapons on his own people, we did. And I'm quite sure people in MI6 know exactly what we're talking about. Those people should be sent to The Hague. And they shouldn't be executed, because I don't believe in capital punishment, but they should go to prison for life, and life should mean life. That's the only way to put a stop to international terrorism at its heartland in the NATO intelligence agencies.
Okay, back to the Commons. And Angus had another question.
More than 450 UK service personnel have died in Afghanistan, but sadly the Taliban are back. The UK spent 13 times more bombing Libya than in rebuilding the country, and there has been anarchy. The US has just dropped a $500 million programme to support the Syrian opposition. Russia is bombing Syria, and the UK has no plan to help refugees from Syria who are now in... The UK has no plan to help Syrian refugees who have made it...
I think the Honourable Gentleman is reaching the conclusion of his question, but he must be allowed to do so. Mr. Angus Robertson.
It's a shame that members on the government side do not acknowledge that the UK has no policy to help Syrian refugees who have made it to Europe. There is no surprise that there's growing scepticism about the drumbeat towards war. Will the Prime Minister give an assurance that he has learned the lessons of Iraq, of Afghanistan and Libya, and he will never repeat them?
Well, I'd say a couple of things to the Honourable Gentleman. I can't remember a question with so many errors in being asked. That Britain isn't helping Syrian refugees when we are the second largest bilateral donor to Syrian refugee camps in Jordan, in Lebanon, in Turkey, and that's because we're spending 0.7% of our gross national income on aid. We've done more than almost any other country in the world to help Syrian refugees. But frankly, I don't recognise the picture he paints of Afghanistan. The fact is, we have supported an Afghan national army and police force and an Afghan government that are in control of that country. But the final point I'd make to him is, it's all very well standing on his high horse and lecturing about the past. Would he be happier with an Afghanistan that had a Taliban regime and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan? Would he be happier with Gaddafi running Libya? Would he be happier with that situation? So, as I said, the consequences of non-intervention are also worth considering.
Well, I mean, as I've said earlier, Tony, the fact is that we already have evidence that the armed uprising in Syria was put together by the NATO intelligence services working with the Saudis and the Qataris. It wasn't just a spontaneous uprising that turned violent. We've got evidence of that from Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, who made it absolutely clear that that's what some of the case is. So in other words, talking about this as if it's all a faraway country and we're trying to react to events and it's nothing to do with us, in actual fact, we started the war in Syria.
But the question by Angus Robertson is, has Cameron learned the lesson?
Well, the answer obviously is no, and the fact is that even questions by Angus Robertson there are insufficiently sharp. The fact is that we have started these conflicts. We started them. I mean, on the bigger scale, it's fairly obvious that ISIS wouldn't exist if Tony Blair hadn't agreed to invade Iraq. Ultimately, the British government itself accepts that the Taliban will have to be part of a political solution in Afghanistan. So all of the British soldiers that have died trying to stop the Taliban are going to have to swallow the fact that ultimately that British policy is to talk to the Taliban, and they will have to have some kind of say in the Afghan government. And since they represent a substantial chunk of the Afghan people, the kind of people that kicked out the Russians, kicked out the British, kicked out the Americans, they can't be stopped from having a say. And then they shouldn't be stopped from having a say. And what we have done in all of these countries is tried to impose our will so that we could get what we needed in terms of access to oil, in terms of creation of oil pipelines and so on and so forth. And we have failed and created chaos. And now we say, oh gosh, these refugees, are we prepared to help them? Whatever. The point is, what we should do is end all support for armed groups inside Syria and prosecute those on the British side who have been training and arming them. And I'm quite certain that there are individuals who could be easily got hold of by the British authorities who are definitely involved in arming and training militants in Syria. And when the Prime Minister has gone about Al-Qaeda in Syria, we have been arming and training Al-Qaeda in Syria. There's no doubt about it. The SAS have definitely been involved in doing it. Something needs to be done about that.
On the positive side, this week we've heard the withdrawal of a prison contract, haven't we, from Saudi Arabia under a bit of pressure from Labour. Cameron has decided, no, this isn't appropriate for us to be helping lock up people in Saudi Arabia and possibly be involved in things like public beheadings.
Well, I can suggest to the Prime Minister that maybe if we're going to support armed uprisings, it's time for the SAS to train armed uprising people who want to have an armed uprising in Syria, in Saudi Arabia, where they have no elections at all. Assad's had an election, he's won it. They don't have any elections in Saudi Arabia. They've carried out a war of aggression against Yemen. It's time for the people to rise up. If we believe in bloody revolution in Syria, we believe in bloody revolution. Maybe the Muslim Brotherhood should start fighting the army in Egypt, and then that the SAS will train them and the RAF will come in to bomb the Egyptian positions as we did in Libya. Now, in other words, it's Cameron with his attack on Libya which has opened the door to revolutionary warfare. Revolutionary warfare cuts both ways. Your pet regimes, Qatar doesn't have have elections, we're going to have a new, there's going to be a new British naval base in Bahrain. The locals there are very, very unhappy about it. And of course, if British personnel are attacked by Bahraini militants who say, we don't want your naval base here, it's no use going home and saying crying for your mummy. We believe in armed uprising don't we? We believe in it in Syria, and if we believe in it in Syria, we believe in it. And that cuts both ways.
One of the oft-forgotten fallouts from this is the refugees who are having to make their way from Syria, usually through Turkey, sometimes across the Mediterranean into Europe. Why is it that, I mean, there have been lots of these refugee camps in Turkey. Why is it that it's literally only over the last few months that those refugees who've been there, some of them for years, have found it impossible to stay in those camps and found that they have to then try and make their way to Europe? The timing just seems a little bit peculiar.
Well, it is peculiar, but of course the Turks initially were quite happy for refugees to flee across the border into Turkey, because they then used those refugee camps as places where they could locate and identify ISIS militants who could then be inserted into Syria as guerrilla fighters, pretty similar to what the British SAS and the American CIA did in Afghanistan. And of course they were quite happy to have the refugees to begin with, because it's all part of a coordinated plan to take down Assad. Now of course the Assad regime has shown itself to be far too strong for them, so now the Turkish government, and they are to blame, have basically opened the doors of these camps and shooed everybody in the direction of Europe, because they want more pressure on the Europeans to settle the business and allow them to go in and remove Assad. I mean, the Erdogan has been pushing for a no-fly zone over Syria and maybe for a military intervention by the Turks. But I'm afraid the Russian army and the Hezbollah and the Iranians are in the way. They are actually crushing ISIS as we speak, and therefore there's no prospect whatsoever of removing Assad. And as I said earlier, it wasn't Assad that used chemical weapons on his own people, it was NATO, and that means people in MI6 and CIA know exactly who did it. They were the perpetrators.
And what about this term, the deep state? Where does this come from? What does it mean?
Well, it's been around for quite a while. There's a former Canadian diplomat called Peter Dale Scott, who I think is the source of the original term. And what it means is we go through the charade of having elections and voting for, you know, the ostensible politicians who make the decisions. And behind the scenes, the intelligence services linked with the arms companies and the banks are the power that be. They are the permanent government, and they engage in all sorts of skullduggery to get their way. And in a country like Turkey, which has been on and off a military dictatorship, on and off a semi-democracy, the deep state is extremely pervasive. You've got people who regard the state as theirs. No, it doesn't belong to the people, and they feel that they have the right to do what they want in order to achieve their goals. But it isn't a Turkish phenomenon. This deep state phenomenon is in one sense universal, but in another sense is very much to do with NATO and the NATO countries.
And certainly one part of that has got to be the media. And I mentioned at the top of the hour, we've got a lot of fake stories over the last couple of weeks. Russian jets apparently being shot down, that then they don't get shot down at all. There's a story in the Express, which is still up there, saying a Russian jet was shot down when it wasn't. And also today, just this morning, a bit of a scare story about a jet being shot down. It turns out actually it was a drone. Slightly surreal, because it was warned three times before it was shot down, which is part of the protocol. I'm not sure quite what a drone's reaction is to being warned, and whether it's actually able to reply if it is warned that it's going to be shot down. There's also other stories about cruise missiles crashing in Iran, which are then denied. So the process by which these stories are actually verified seems to have fallen down. They're going right around the world 10 times before anyone realises that they're a load of rubbish.
Yeah, and you might think, well, why in this day and age do people tell fibs like this, which are going to be found out? And the fact of the matter is, it does work, because a certain proportion of the population believes the first thing they hear. So even when it's subsequently debunked, they don't necessarily hear about the debunking. They only hear about the first spin on the story that they get.
Isn't there also an element of wishful thinking here? It's almost as if somebody somewhere in the media actually wants this to happen, or the military, or whoever is actually writing these stories. They haven't verified it themselves, quite obviously, because it's not true. So where do these stories come from?
Well, many of them are sourced in the intelligence services. People think intelligence services are out there to find things out. An awful lot of what they do is sow disinformation That is their role. And so there's a German journalist who said that he worked for the CIA for many, many years, senior journalist on many publications in Germany. He said, I wasn't the only one. So basically, they get phoned up by their contacts in the intelligence services. We want you to tell everybody that the Russian missiles, which were fired from the Caspian Sea, crashed inside Iran. Because that's a way to kind of this kind of constant drumbeat of disinformation. It's what they call strategic communications, Stratcom. In other words, what actually happens is instead of trying to tell people the truth so that they can make up their minds about the policies being pursued, they're fed a diet of lies so that they believe what the government wants them to believe. And I mean by the government, not necessarily the elected leadership, but the deep state that we've been identifying in our earlier discussion.
Now, it's not the first time this kind of thing's been going on at all. And I was quite amazed to hear the other week on Start the Week, I think it was, on the BBC, Frederick Forsyth was on there. Just tell us a little bit about his background, Martin, because I know he was working in journalism and then he became an author, and he was also working with the intelligence services too.
Well, I don't know that much about Frederick Forsyth, although, of course, I've read his books years ago. I mean, basically, he was a British spook. And, you know, his books are based loosely upon his own experiences of working in that field.
Yeah, he was working in Biafra, Nigeria, and there was some sort of split. Can you just give us a little bit of the background of what was going on in Biafra?
Well, that's a long time ago, but Biafra wanted independence from Nigeria, and it was encouraged in that desire for independence by various forces in the West who thought that they could manipulate Biafra for their own purposes.
And this is in the 1960s?
It's in the 1960s, yeah.
Okay, well, let's have a listen now to Frederick Forsyth on the BBC a couple of weeks ago.
We should, in passing, we can't go to it frame by frame, but your time in the 60s with the BBC ends with your absolute fury about BBC coverage of the Biafran War in Nigeria and the BBC's attitude. I wondered whether that whole experience changed you, made you almost disillusioned with journalism, because a lone reporter will see terrible things, will write or film terrible things, but is always going to be at the mercy of an organisation, of a newspaper editor, of the BBC, whatever. Did that enrage you? Was that a changing point for you?
Well, working for... It wasn't so much the working for the BBC, it wasn't even so much the BBC. It was the slavishness of the BBC to the government. The government of Harold Wilson at that time had been extremely ill-advised by what was then called the Commonwealth Relations Office to support the Nigerian dictatorship on the grounds that this war would be over in 4 weeks anyway. You know, the East Nigerians had risen in insurrection after a series of pogroms against them, intertribal pogroms, and they declared the Sovereign Republic of Biafra, which of course was a fiction, but it was a Nigerian civil war, and I didn't see why our country was helping a dictatorship to kill its own people. We've never done that before, we've never done it since, and we shouldn't have done it at the time, but they were advised to do it, and I went down there, was sent down there, saw what was happening, realised that the four-week forecast was rubbish. This war was going to go on and on and on. There were going to be massive casualties unless it was stopped artificially, like the Syrian, you know, we've seen. Syrian civil war wasn't going to last 4 weeks once. Yeah, okay, how many million dead, how many million,
you walked out and then you went rogue. I mean, you went as a freelance, you went back again so you could cover it
I came back to this country and I had it up and down with the editor of Foreign News, and but what the clincher was, and when I said, well, you know, why will you not let me go back and cover this war? And his response was, we are not covering this war. Mm. So I thought, no, I didn't become a journalist to get stuck into managed news. If I wanted to be a PRO, I'd be a PRO. And I'd publish bulletins, so official communications.
Well, I mean, he particularly picks up the cause of Biafra there, but I just, as I mentioned earlier, how many Western journalists have gone to Kurdistan in Turkey and reported on NATO crushing a national uprising? How many people have been to Bahrain to talk to the people of Bahrain who are absolutely unhappy with their government because it's a pro-Western government? They don't go. And I think I have a question for Frederick Forsyth. When you were going to Nigeria, you weren't working for the BBC anymore, but were you still working for British intelligence? Because the idea of you as a completely independent voice, when you've admitted that you are actually a spook for MI6, we've got a question mark about that. Why did you go? Who paid for it? maybe you're not so as independent as you claim.
No, I think he's saying that he was going out there to write as a freelance, basically, to get stuff in press because he was so annoyed about the way the BBC had been covering it.
Well, yeah, but he's also admitted that he was actually at one stage an MI6 agent. Was he an MI6 agent when he was in Biafra? Yes or no?
Well, maybe they recruited him. Who knows? Anyway, on to the next part of this story about really to do with the media and the current tension in Eastern Europe and the Middle East, which is the Dutch investigators, Martin, this week have said that the Malaysian airliner MH17 was shot down by a Russian-made missile. With very little more analysis than that, I was watching Newsnight, I think it was Tuesday evening, to see what they would make of it all, and of course it didn't even appear, nothing about it at all. What do you make of the Dutch report?
Well, I was on RT earlier this week talking about this. It's very difficult to comment on a report which you can't read unless until it comes out. But I would say this, and this is what I said. If it is a Buk missile, and I have my doubts about that, because in actual fact, other stuff I've been reading suggests that the Dutch actually haven't got the evidence that it was a Buk missile, and that missiles could include bullets from an air-to-air attack, and that they're actually...
Well, it could be an air-to-air missile, potentially.
Well, indeed. So what I said is, let's just presume for the sake of argument that it was a Buk missile, although the Russians aren't accepting that, and nor am I. But let's assume for the sake of argument that it was. The Ukrainian armed forces have 5 batteries of Buk missiles, several hundred of them. The rebels in East Ukraine have no such batteries. None at all, and they're not trained to use them. It's quite a sophisticated piece of equipment. You can't just get hold of it and use it.
I suppose it's one of those things where you could get hold of a Buk missile battery, but it might take you weeks to work out how to use the thing.
Yes, indeed. So the only if it was a Russian, if so, in other words, Russian-made missile was used, perhaps. But in actual fact, far more likely to be a Ukrainian missile than a Russian missile. Because if it was a Russian missile, it would have to have been a Russian regular army unit. And despite all the huffing and puffing, I don't think NATO have been able to stand up under any circumstances the idea that regular Russian military have been involved in this conflict. They've been advisers, they've been hanging around in the background like the SAS in Syria.
No, they're saying the rebels did it.
But the rebels haven't got any Buk missiles. They haven't got any. And even if they couldn't use them.
They were saying that they did have.
Yeah, well, there's no evidence that they have. Don't forget that this is a militia, a scratch militia. They have no high-level hardware. What was happening is that they were quite successfully using handheld anti-aircraft missiles to shoot down incoming military aircraft from the Ukrainian side. They were doing quite... I mean, the Ukrainians were basically carrying out indiscriminate bombing of eastern Ukraine, pretty similar to the sort of things that the Saudis are now doing in Yemen with British military equipment.
Well, what possible motive could there be for, say, the Ukrainian armed forces to shoot down a Malaysian airliner?
Because then you then say, oh, the Russians did this, and of course sanctions, most European, Western European countries were still doubtful about sanctions on Russia over what was going on. Don't forget that the sniper attack in the Maidan Square, it had been exposed that was actually carried out by pro-regime, new regime forces, not by the Yanukovych regime. And so throughout everything that's gone on in the Ukraine, there has been the consistent use of false flag tactics by the Ukrainians because they've been trained by NATO. They're in bed with NATO intelligence services. So the attack on the trade union headquarters in Odessa was deliberately set up as a psychological warfare false flag attack.
But before we get too far away from MH17, mm-hmm. that was also diverted, wasn't it, several hundred miles to the north from its original track, and also down 2,000 feet so that it was just literally skimming above the maximum height that the Ukrainians have said was safe to fly in.
Yeah, so, well, the Dutch Safety Board have, to their credit, said, well, they shouldn't have been having any planes flying over this zone anyway. And in a sense, that's right. Shouldn't have been any planes flying over that zone.
Yeah, the BBC actually did a report on this, which I found particularly pernicious, where they said, oh, well, several other airlines were flying on this route, and that was what the BBC said. What the BBC didn't tell you was that actually far more airlines had decided we're not going to go anywhere near Ukraine, including British Airways, that said we're not going anywhere near Ukraine. The BBC didn't mention that in their report, which does suspect makes me suspect they're trying to spin the story.
Well, of course they're trying to spin the story. They're lying, basically. I mean, if we take the worst possible explanation of events, a regular army Russian unit was infiltrated into East Ukraine, presumably to back up the handheld anti-aircraft fire that the rebels were quite successfully using, as rebels in Syria are now doing against the Russians with anti-aircraft, handheld anti-aircraft weaponry supplied by CIA NATO. But the fact is, a Buk missile, which is designed to take down kind of flying fortresses, effectively, you know, big planes at high altitude, there wouldn't be much sense for the Russians to send that in, because they're not being attacked by flying fortresses. They're being attacked by low-flying, you know, like tornado-style low-flying bombers.
OK, on MH17, finally, little or no or zero evidence from the black box and the most important cockpit voice recorder. Now, we're told that there's nothing to see, but we haven't seen the evidence that there's nothing to see. Why is that?
Well, what's very bizarre about this whole investigation is that it hasn't been carried out according to the procedures of the international aviation
industry. No, indeed, the Malaysian government and Malaysian Airlines were actually shut out of the inquiry until they agreed to sign a secrecy deal and a gagging clause, which included things like you're not allowed to do post-mortems on bodies when we send them back to Malaysia. That, for example, of the pilot and the co-pilot.
Indeed. And I understand that Australian police officers who were involved on the ground are not very happy with the position their government's taking on all of this. Now, you've got to ask yourself a question. If normal procedure isn't being followed, why? Why are the Ukrainians being allowed to be involved in the investigation when they are suspects? If you're going to allow Ukrainians to be involved, you've got to allow the Russian side to be involved as well.
Well, so why have the British actually still got the cockpit voice recorder?
Indeed, why did the British end up with the black? They should have gone to an independent third country, surely, not to Britain, which is part of NATO. The allegation here is that NATO intelligence services carried out the sniper attack in Maidan, the attack in Odessa, and shot down this plane as part of a blackened Russia programme. That is the allegation. And actually, that is most likely what's happened.
And 3 weeks after the MH17 crash, there was the mysterious resignation of Andrei Perubi, who is the Pravi Sector far-right fascist defence secretary of Ukraine.
Yeah.
And no explanation at all for why he resigned.
Well, I suspect that elements within NATO intelligence services working with the far-right groups in Ukraine are working together to escalate the situation. And they're quite prepared to kill a lot of innocent people in an aeroplane in order to get their goals. Because, as we know, in the past, we're perhaps going to come on to discuss Lockerbie in a minute, NATO intelligence services frequently use aircraft and airports as for their provocations. And that's because, of course, they control the security in aircraft and airports. And that's why it's easy to carry out provocations.
Perfect timing, Martin. Lockerbie, two new suspects, both locked up in Libyan jails, both connected with the Libyan intelligence services. For Lockerbie.
Yeah, but all of the evidence about Lockerbie, I think, points in exactly the opposite direction. There's a brilliant film about this, as you know, by Frankovich, called The Maltese Double Cross. I put it to people listening to this show.
Well, we had an interview, didn't we, with Susan Lindauer, who came up with a very different story.
Yes, that's right, and she's ex-CIA. She basically pointed the finger at the CIA for planting the bomb.
Do you want to just run us through, in a nutshell, what she was saying was the real cause?
Well, don't forget that the plane on which the bomb went off had actually flown from Beirut to London. It had been nowhere near Libya. So her allegation, there are two possibilities. The bomb went on in Beirut or the bomb went on in London. The idea that a bomb went on in a suitcase in Malta, which then went to Frankfurt, which then got put on the plane in Frankfurt, just doesn't add up.
Well, we also heard from Jim Swire, didn't we, the father of one of the victims, that there was a break-in at Heathrow airside that same night that the aircraft took off. So it's very possible.
Well, it's
possible it was put on in London.
Indeed, it's possible it was put on in London. But let me put it to you this way. It's extremely unlikely that somebody went... The allegation is that Megrahi went to Malta with a suitcase bomb. He placed it on a plane flying to Frankfurt and then didn't get on the plane. And then the plane flew to Frankfurt and the suitcase was transferred from from the connecting plane to the other plane without a passenger. That just doesn't add up. It makes a lot more sense to think of the bomb going on either in Beirut or in London. And, of course, Beirut would be an obvious place
to
look.
So why frame these people who are in jail now in Libya?
I think because of the question marks that there have been about MH17 and other things, MH30 and so on, they're trying to rewrite history. Megrahi was originally released by the Scottish government because his appeal was about to come up in front of the Scottish courts, and a Scottish inspector in the police force, was going to testify that the CIA had interfered with the crime scene, to wit, they had planted a circuit board which supposedly implicated the Libyans. Now, as various people have pointed out, a circuit board from a bomb would not survive the bomb. So there's an even a logical point here. That circuit board, if it was part of a bomb, would not have survived. So the whole implication of Libya was based around this circuit board, which doesn't add up, because if the bomb had blown up, the circuit board wouldn't even have been there. And that supposedly was a circuit board which the Libyans had got from East Germany and so on. And of course, the bomb was supposedly have gone on at Malta on a connecting flight to Frankfurt. All of which are, frankly, incredible allegations and don't make any sense at all.
I think if anyone wants to follow up the Lockerbie story, still the wonderful Frankovich film made for Channel 4 and eventually even shown on Channel 4, Maltese Double Cross, well worth a look. Martin, let's move on now to talk about Israel and Palestine. There will be no peace until Israel's occupation of Palestine ends. That's Marwan Barghouti in The Guardian. The current escalation of violence didn't start with the killing of two Israeli settlers. It started a long while ago and has been going on for years. Now, people are talking about this as a new intifada. Also, things like the Al-Aqsa Mosque being closed in East Jerusalem, demolition of homes of Palestinians as well, increasing apace. What's your prognosis of what's going on here?
Well, I think the Israelis are upping the ante because they are hoping that a general Middle East war, which may well break out, will give them the opportunity for a final solution of their Palestinian problem. That's what I read. I mean, I think they're there provoking the Palestinians at the minute.
I mean, the idea
in order to try and finish the job off as they see it.
I mean, Mark Urban actually last night on Newsnight talked about Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
Well, that's just provocative, because nobody recognises it as the capital of Israel apart from the Israelis.
Well, why is Mark Urban doing that, the foreign correspondent for Newsnight?
Because they're in the pocket of the Israeli government.
we're in a very difficult situation, particularly in East Jerusalem. And the idea was that Jerusalem was going to be shared between the Jews and the indigenous Palestinian population.
Well, if the two-state solution was going to be carried out, which of course it isn't going to be carried out because the Israelis are making it impossible to be carried out. But of course, you know, the Prime Minister earlier was talking about the legitimate rebels in Syria and that we're not pacifists and people have got a right to resist the terrorist state of Syria. Well, the Palestinians could draw exactly the same conclusion. There's no point talking to the Israelis. They're not interested in peace. The only thing they understand is violence, and therefore, just like Britain in 1940, the time has come to just fight to the finish to destroy the state of Israel. That's the logic, isn't it?
In The Guardian also, Gilad Erdan is saying Israel is not seeking to change the status of Temple Mount. Freedom to worship for all religions will continue. If Palestinian leaders truly wanted calm, they would tell their people the truth. And he's saying the terror in Jerusalem is based on a lie. And that lie is that a paranoia, apparently, according to Gilad Erdan in the Guardian, spreading this lie through the Palestinian community that they will be stopped from worshipping at Al-Aqsa.
Well, the fact is that everybody under the age of 55 has been banned from the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They won't let young potential rioters or whatever anywhere near it. It's bound to be a sensitive issue however you approach it. But the fact is that the state of Israel in its current borders is illegal. They have no right to East Jerusalem. They have no right to the Al-Aqsa Mosque. They have no right to the Golan Heights. They have no right to intervene in Gaza.
This goes back
and yet they carry on doing it.
To 1967, doesn't it? A lot of it.
Yeah.
And that was, what is it, the Six-Day War?
Yes, which supposedly was started by the Arabs, but was in fact, again, a manipulation by the Israelis. They provoked it and then seized the land they wanted to seize. And just as we will not accept Assad must go, that is still the policy of the British government. Well, the policy in relation to the Israelis, I would say, should be exactly the same. You get back behind the Green Line agreed in 1948, or otherwise we will go to war with you. And that's, we're not prepared to discuss until you get back behind that green line. There's nothing to discuss, just war, war, war. And of course, ultimately, you will lose. They will lose in the end.
Finally, let's have a look at the Transatlantic Trade Investment Partnership. The Trans-Pacific Partnership has been signed. Martin, some people are talking about this as a great opportunity for world trade. Others as a dictatorship run by banks and corporations. I imagine the truth is somewhere in between.
No, I think the dictatorship by banks and corporations is correct. But what is also, of course, it's directed, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is directed at China, and the Trade and Investment Partnership is directed at Russia, neither of which have been included in the discussions. You'd have thought if you're going to set up an international trade deal, you'd want to have the Chinese involved.
Well, maybe the Russians and the Chinese have just decided they don't want to do the deal.
Well, no, they've not even been talked to. Because, of course, if they were talked to, then the deal would have to be a very different kind of deal.
What about the Chinese role? Because, I mean, it's all very clear, isn't it? In Eastern Europe and in the Middle East, the Russians are playing quite an important part there. What about the Chinese kind of hovering in the background? Well, are they being unscrutable?
No. In East Asia, the same kind of provocations are going on. Effectively, the failing American hegemon is attempting to make the West Europeans, the Europeans, and the Southeast Asian states like Japan and South Korea totally dependent on them going forward. Whereas, of course, the natural development for the Europeans and for the Southeast Asians is to develop productive and constructive relationships with Moscow and Beijing. The Western powers, particularly the US, are determined to prevent that. So these deals, bad as they are on the environment and workers' rights and all the rest of it, and giving corporations the right to sue governments, the other aspect to this is it's a deliberate attempt to freeze out the Russians and the Chinese.
But it's also
Chinese.
Freezing us out as democratic parliaments and the whole rule of law.
Well, it is, but it also, don't forget that the European Union is at this moment paying a huge price for sanctions on Russia. It's not the Americans that are paying that price. So what the Americans are doing is sabotaging the economy of Japan, South Korea and Western Europe because they won't allow them to develop independent relations with China and Russia. They're being kept under the thumb.
I mean, all of this is actually bringing China and Russia together as an enormous counterblock to Europe and the United States.
Yes, and of course the Russian intervention in Syria is a big game changer. It has shocked and awed the Western foreign policy establishment, not least the firing of the cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea. They didn't expect that. And of course, the Iraqi government and the Iranian government agreed for those missiles to overfly their territory. The Turks didn't. But of course, if Kurdistan existed, they would have been happy for those missiles to overfly their territory and they could have hit Syria. But of course, the thing about the Caspian Sea is it can't be attacked by NATO navies. It's a landlocked sea.
Okay,
so they can fire from the Caspian Sea and nobody can stop them.
Okay, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that was Simon Cook. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our shows at thisweek.org.uk, along with lots of links as well. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. I'm wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do join us on the Politics Show at 5 next week. And